Good evening. Welcome, audience, radio listeners, and TV viewers to 360 North's new series, Arts at 360. I'm Scott Burton, Arts, Music, and Culture producer at 360 North and K2. Tonight's program is our Writers Showcase, an ongoing series of themed readings that feature established and aspiring Alaskan writers. Tonight's subject is the holidays, and we are proud to present several short stories and essays. Some authors have chosen to read their own work, while others have elected to have actors present their writing. Our first work is by Heather Lendy. Heather is the New York Times best-selling author of If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name, and Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. She has lived in Haines for 30 years. This time of year, she sings carols with the choir and is more or less part of another not quite so traditional holiday tradition, which we'll hear about in her piece. Our reader is Christina Apathy. Christina grew up on the Gulf Coast of Florida, lived in New York City's West Village, and has called Juno home for the past 7 years. She is a theater artist, independent producer, singer, classical actress, and dialect coach. Christina is the recipient of a national TCG Fox Fellowship Award for resident actors, and this past November accepted Perseverance Theater's Bishop Michael Kenney Award for artistic collaboration. Christina will read Heather's essay, All is Bright and Not So Calm for the Holidays in Haines.
When I was young, December meant Handel's Messiah, sung by a choir in a candlelit church. I was taught to take a piece of flaming plum pudding at Christmas dinner, even though no one under 70 actually ate it. That wasn't the point. It was our tradition. For years, I missed those East Coast holidays and tried without success to replicate them in Alaska. I no longer feel obligated to order plum pudding from a gourmet catalog. I've realized that while I was wishing my Haines Christmases were more traditional, they have gone and become so in their own bright and loud way. It really wouldn't be Christmas without the parade. And you couldn't call it a parade without the snow dragon. With its giant foam head, flashing red eyes, roars and smoke, and 27-foot-long sheet-draped body manned by 8 of us. Our heads poke through the holes in halved plastic oil drums and are disguised with serpentine fin hats that make us legally blind. It's not only scary to look at and makes children cry, it's dangerous. The rest of the parade consists of a lot of fireworks and all the emergency vehicles in town. For better or worse, the parade and the snow dragon is tradition. Like plum pudding, and it's ours. Which may be why some residents planned a more Currier and Ives-style celebration to go with it. The lighting of the historic Fort Seward neighborhood, featuring sledding, a nativity play, caroling, and a hot dog roast. The community women's choir was even asked to sing. My mother, no doubt, would have been much more pleased with this than the parade, which she compared to the Tet Offensive. Maybe because she had died that spring, but for whatever reason, I was nostalgic and looking forward to this first, more traditional Christmas celebration. The choir had prepared Hark the Herald Angels and O Come All Ye Faithful in 4-part harmony, but rather than robes, we wore coats, snow pants, hats, and headlamps to see the music with. We stood in the inky dark behind Tresham Gregg's art shop at the bottom of the parade grounds, waiting for the cannon to trigger the lighting of the 100-year-old homes surrounding the field. The only lights were candles in the milk jugs outlining the sledding hill. Then, from somewhere up by the flagpole, Jim Shook hollered, "Cover your ears!" We did. Nothing happened. Yes, Shook really is his name, and you'll see in a minute how perfect it is. "Cover your ears!" Jim yelled again. One woman, who was new in town, wondered if that was necessary since we were a couple hundred yards away and it was a toy cannon, right? Actually, Jim's 3,000-pound cannon was originally designed to launch harpoons from whaling ships. Each firing, the 4th of July, Memorial Day, and now the lighting of the fort requires a pound of black powder and a pile of old blue jeans. Jim packs the barrel with rags, denim works best, lights the fuse, and waits for the big bang. One time, he shot a pair of Levi's clear over Tresham's shop, probably the farthest any pair of jeans has ever flown. After Jim's third, "Cover your ears!" there was a huge kaboom, followed by stunned wows. The ground shifted. I felt the concussion on my face. The background was dazzlingly bright as all the Christmas lights came on. Then Todd Siebens launched a bunch of fireworks, no doubt practicing for the parade, where he is in charge of teasing the dragon with firecrackers and bottle rockets, while Mary, Joseph, and the baby doll that was Jesus waited on the shop porch to perform the pageant. I did not know how important our choir was to the show, of which our leader, Nancy Nash, seemed to be in charge of. Turns out, Nancy wasn't either. Holly Davis was supposed to do it, but she caught the flu. Holly was born on Christmas and has stayed faithful ever since. Her husband is Matthew, and their little boys are Mark, Luke, and John. Nancy is an organizer, so she jumped in, and our chorus led the sing-along. My mother, a Long Island Episcopalian, would have approved of Holly's script, which was right out of Luke's gospel, the one that begins, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." With each scene, we sang a verse of the corresponding carol. "O little town of Bethlehem, silent night, angels we have heard on high," as well as the two we had actually practiced, for which we had waterproof music. The snow was falling in earnest, while mothers herded shepherds, tinsel-haloed angels, and kings to their places. I stood next to a friend who didn't know the words to all the carols. I was surprised that I did. I owe this to my mother, who made sure her daughters learned to sing them whether we wanted to or not. Standing in the snow, miles and years from where I first sang them, the words from Green Sleeves and "It Came Upon a Midnight Clear" flowed right back. It's an odd feeling to be almost 50 and realize that something you learned as a child has paid off. It's like discovering a use for algebra. Half the crowd missed the nativity play and our carols. They were on the front side of the shop, roasting hot dogs, or thinking about roasting hot dogs, over a bonfire of shipping pallets that threatened to char a totem pole. Ever since I was hit by a truck and almost killed while riding my bike, I have made a habit of visualizing the worst case scenario and how I will survive it or even help others to. In hotels, I note where the exits are. On airplanes, I study the instructions for inflating the emergency slide. Now, I looked at the inferno leaping into the sky. A nearby volunteer fireman agreed that if the pole caught fire, it would crash into the lighted spruce tree, which would then burst into flames and fall onto the power lines, showering sparks over the barracks building. It's long vacant, so probably no one would get hurt, but the boom and flash of the crash and burn would make the cannon blast seem like a firecracker. Luckily, as Tiny Tim said, God blessed us, everyone, and the fire stayed put. Which I believed was a good omen for the upcoming parade. Every year, I take my place under the dragon's sheeting behind Pizza Joe, a poet who used to deliver pizza and is now the assistant harbor master, who leads us from underneath the dragon's full body-sized head. Strapped to my chest is a 50-pound fire extinguisher filled with flour. When Pizza Joe tips the dragon's nostrils up, I squeeze the extinguisher and the dragon snorts out a white cloud of flour smoke. The dragon fumes and roars down Main Street, while half a dozen teens and adults like Todd Siebens, dressed as Robin Hood's merry band, run alongside, tossing lit firecrackers, waving sparklers, and launching fireworks. This year, we almost didn't haul the bedraggled dragon out again. Some of the old-timers wanted to retire rather than repair it. But a few of us insisted. Okay, mainly, it was me. No doubt sounding like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof when I wailed, "It's tradition!" That nutty dragon transforms our flat-roofed, practical northern town perched above the free fish-freezing cove into something magical, exotic, and weirdly hopeful. We need a little spark at Christmas time. As we readied it for the parade, I watched one of the gray ponytailed dragonaires limp across the Elks Hall and was glad that I had coerced three of my children into suiting up this year. The dragon is hard work. They had brought some friends, too. Pizza Joe took his place in the head, but when I stepped toward mine, Crystal, a shy nursing student back for the holidays, stepped in. "I have wanted to do this my whole life," she said. "I heard they were looking for new dragon people." For her, the dragon is the only Christmas tradition. There was one spot left. The rest were filled with other youthful dragon novices. To keep traditions, elders must pass them down. My mother made sure I learned English carols. I made sure my children did, and that they had this dragon. But being in it is my tradition, isn't it? Luke's gospel last week reminded me that this is the season of goodwill towards all men, and women, and children as well, I figure. So I gave Crystal a few pointers about the fire extinguisher that she didn't need. And for the first time, I watched the dragon weave its way down Main Street in a haze of gunpowder and fireworks to the sounds of crying babies, sirens, and the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, its theme song, blaring from a boombox under the back end. And you know what? Right on cue, it tipped back its head and belched a plume of smoke, dusting the crowd from head to toe in flour. My mother was concerned to the end that her Alaskan grandchildren may never know the proper Christmas traditions. This year, they heard both the old music and sacred stories and got to be in the dragon. I know now, too, what glad tidings of comfort and joy means. May you find some, too. And if you're feeling a little blue, sing some carols, blow in a bag of flour, and light a few firecrackers. I guarantee you'll be the merrier for it.
Our next work tonight is a short story that blurs fiction and reality by Joan Pardis. A former journalist, Joe now writes essays, poetry, and fiction, along with technical gigs for her business, Partis Public Relations. Her work has appeared in Alaska Magazine's anthology and a variety of magazines and newspapers. Joan lives in Juneau with her husband and daughter. Joan's piece, What's in the Soup, will be read by Shona Strausser. Shona is an actor, singer, theater director, and arts director.
I'm a transplanted New Yorker living in Alaska, and even though I've lived here for 15 years, I'm still a little in love with the place. It's the type of love that continually takes me by surprise. Sure, there are some days when it's the same old, but there are also days when I find myself swooning. Yes, swooning. Over yet another new discovery, or even over something that transformed from what I thought was mundane into something spectacular. I think that's what I love best about Alaska. Its transformative powers. Like for instance, just the other day, I was cooking in my kitchen, and through the steam fog of soup preparations, I saw my long-deceased grandmother in her bathroom-sized, spotless kitchen in the Bronx. Now, some of my neighbors say they can see Russia from their houses, but my view apparently only goes to the Bronx. Anyway, Nana, my grandmother, was also cooking up a storm, and even though I couldn't smell her soup, I knew it was going to be better than mine. So she was waving and I was blubbering and trying to tell her, in between my sobs, how much I missed her and all about her great-granddaughter. When it became apparent that while I could see her world perfectly, she couldn't see mine. She kept on asking in her Bronx accent, Alaska? Really? But tell me again why you moved and stayed in such a place. And since I couldn't show her, I had to put it in words. So I made a cup of tea and turned the soup on high to keep my steamy portal going and had a chat with Nana about my life in Alaska. It was December, so I told her about the magic of living in Alaska during the winter months, how my body cycle slowed down to match the limited daylight, and I turned inward to write and read along with making crafts, working on puzzles, and playing endless games with my family and friends. She was surprised to find out that I was no longer handicraft impaired, but laughed when I told her that I finally found a place that matched my inner clock. The sun actually rises around 9 in the winter. Not that I can be the sleepy head of my youth with my family to take care of. I then tried to explain, without much success, how my new home is an actual part of me, that I finally understand the phrase, sense of place. Sure, other places I lived, like Manhattan and LA, were characters in their own right. But living in Alaska is different. Somehow, being surrounded by mountains makes me feel small and powerful, and the seasons and the natural elements have seeped into me. Or more aptly, I've become a part of them. At this point, it looked like Nana was starting to fall asleep at her formica and chrome kitchen table, so I became more concrete and started talking about snow, specifically how I love to snowshoe. She was flabbergasted at this and was now wide awake, so I explained how snow seems to transform more than the terrain. And while I know that the lumps and bumps I scamper over on my little snowshoe trips are fallen trees, running creeks, and the blueberry bushes that I plucked a few months ago, the mere fact that I can't see them makes me feel as if all of life's obstacles can be clumped over with the right pair of shoes and a new outlook. I then whispered my little snowshoe secret, that even though there might be footprints in the snow, I consciously don't follow them. Sometimes I walk side by side of where someone walked before, parallel to another set of tracks, but never in the same imprint, though I will from time to time wander after a deer or rabbit trail. She chortled, a Nana chortle, and muttered that some things never change, and why would anyone want to walk in the cold with things strapped to their feet and wild animals about? But when I talked to her about the winter sky and the northern lights, she leaned forward and said in a hoarse voice, without a trace of sarcasm, So they really exist. Those lights are not like some fairy tale. I told her that the Aurora Borealis, what? The Northern Lights are very much like a fairy tale, but real. And that for me, witnessing a Northern Light display is proof that magic still exists, that science can explain almost anything, and there is a higher power all at the same time. She got a little quiet and then said, I would have liked to see that. After a while, she asked, but what about the people? You have no family up there. What do you do for the holidays? I sighed and told her that I never felt more at home. That recently a friend of mine said that there is a place for everyone where they can be their true selves. The trick is to find it. And I felt that I was lucky enough to stumble into the place where I was meant to be. With tears streaming down my face, I told her how I missed the relatives back east, but I found a new extended family in Alaska where people still help each other. And my daughter just goes out and plays without any prearranged dates with her gal pals. Neighbors drop by, just like her friends did in the Bronx. I have good friends to lean on and let loose with, and a partner who I love deeply and who loves me. But what about the holidays? What do you do? I laughed and told her it's a long winter, so we do it all. We celebrate Hanukkah, Festival of Lights, Solstice, the shortest day of the year, and Christmas. Oh my, you do have it covered, don't you? She giggled. I then described how my daughter and her friends love to use Nana's china on these special occasions and handle each piece with great care, taking pride in washing and drying each plate, knowing that my grandmother's dishes don't go in the dishwasher. I also told Nana how those same friends seem to be mesmerized when we light the Hanukkah candles and hear my daughter say the ancient prayers. And lastly, I shared how her great-granddaughter recently wrote an essay at school that stated if she could meet anyone, living or dead, that she would want to meet my grandmother. It was Nana's turn to cry a bit. And then, as the cooking haze started to fade, she asked with a shaking voice, when you and your family light the candles for Hanukkah, will you do me a favor? Make some soup. I'd like to see them. And that's what we'll do every year. We'll light candles, say ancient prayers, and make soup so my grandmother can see my family. And more importantly, so my Alaskan-born, born and bred daughter can get a glimpse of a tiny bathroom-sized kitchen in the Bronx. And the woman who taught me that you don't have to completely understand someone to love and support them as they discover their own path, no matter where it leads them.
Our next writer tonight is Clint Farr. Clint is a regular contributor to the Juno Empire's entertainment section. He has also been published in the Alaska Dispatch and Anchorage Daily News and has contributed on-air movie reviews and essays to public radio. Above all, Clint is a husband to an amazing wife and father to two fantastic and spirited girls. Clint will read his essay, Valdez Christmas.
A Valdez Christmas. Andres Valdez and I were students at Colorado State University. We met mucking out the basement of a Habitat for Humanity house. A robust fellow, Andres could carry two buckets of muck to my one. His dark eyes danced in the basement when he spoke of his Christian faith, how it nudged him into volunteerism. He spoke reverently of his 8 sisters, 11 brothers, and mom. He also spoke fluent Spanish to the homeowners and the roofers. After finishing the house, we began to meet for coffee. In time, the coffee clatch morphed into a Saturday breakfast with friends. Each breakfast would end in a sing-along of Beatles tunes. Andres became a mentor. He had a girlfriend. I did not. He knew the lyrics to I Am a Walrus. I did not. He would often correct my pronunciation of Valdez to Valdez, Adam. It's Valdez. I would apologize. I'm from Alaska. We became close. Toward the Christmas of my senior year, it was clear I'd be unable to go home to Anchorage for the break. As a kindness, Andres asked if I might come down to Pueblo for the holiday. I'm not completely sure he was expecting me to say yes. Andres and I were quite different. He was religious, I was godless. I didn't push my disbelief on anyone, but I had a pretty negative view of religion up to that time. Due to my early years in rural Alabama, if I heard preaching, the capillary action of my southern roots drew forth the memory of a foaming, angry, myopic ministers, and I didn't like what I saw. Which is why I liked Andres. He was no fire breather. He was quiet. He let his actions speak loudly. If he spoke of God, it was of God's love and grace. Andres warned me on our drive south to Pueblo, there will be religion this weekend. I think I can handle it, I said. Just don't expect me to go to church with you after this. Who said anything about church? Andres asked. The morning of Christmas Eve, I met all the Valdez brothers. We were going to take a long drive to the mountains to go sledding. We arrived at the top of a sizable hill. The hilltop view was the endless chop and breakers of the Rockies, dark green and frothy white with new snow. We unkinked our backs and pulled off the van's roof, a collection of giant truck inner tubes. The brothers sprayed the tubes with silicone, slickening them to an irresponsible degree. A quick inhale, a small shift in weight, the rubbery squeak of snow losing its grip, and gravity took over. We jetted down the hill so fast my cheeks chapped from the windburn. I couldn't catch my breath from laughing. Surely one of us was going to break something important. None of us cared. We were delirious from the snow, sun, and smiles. What a blast. The oldest brother, Conrad, sat next to me in the van as we headed out of the Rockies. We're going to Mass tonight. Will you join us? Sure. I was ambivalent, both needing sleep and not enjoying churches, but what else was I going to do? Conrad looked at me. I'll tell you a little secret. His eyes twinkled a little as he leaned in close like a drunk due to the swaying van. We come up here on Christmas Eve for the thrill of sledding, of course, but also because these mountains, these amazing hills and topography are far greater testimony to God's greatness than any church or anything else built by man for that matter. There's Mass, friend, but there's worship. Sledding's worship. You sound like a hippie, I said. Amen to that, said Andres. And if nature loving wasn't enough to convince me that, for Andres at least, religion was quite a different thing than my Alabama experience, we detoured into a dive bar called the Conquistador for a quick beer. Fact, beer heals windburn, rationalized Conrad. Back at Andres' mom's house, we showered and changed for Mass. I envisioned a Catholic church in Pueblo as a quaint adobe structure with stucco siding and roof arcs topped with little crosses. Instead, we arrived at the home of the oldest sister, Marie. A family friend who was a priest from Uruguay was visiting. He received permission from the local church to minister the Valdez family in a different location, a home. The house buzzed with energy. A home Mass was rare, and everyone was excited. Until now, I hadn't seen any of Andres' eight sisters or his mom. The overwhelming maleness of my Christmas Eve hadn't really hit until I heard the soft and easy laughter of Andres' sisters, a sound I welcomed. At the risk of sounding shallow, I must note here that the Valdez siblings, male and female, look like a bunch of swimmers who modeled in the off-season. For 20 siblings to be so uniformly good-looking defies statistics. This compared to my family, who seem intent on proving that if you eat enough potatoes over your lifetime, you will, when you die, look like a potato. In the living room, enough upholstered folding chairs were set up for everyone. The procession began with a child I hadn't yet met, one of Andres' nephews. He was followed by the visiting priest, adorned in simple vestments, who swung a smoking birdcage of incense. The family broke into singing. Then a brother read from the Old Testament, a reading that rang the bells of long-neglected memory cells. I knew the old stories. The homily was in Spanish, so I didn't hear so much as feel the lesson. I also enjoyed the choreography of the ceremony and was surprised at the athleticism required to participate, what with all the kneeling and standing. Is this normal? I whispered to Andres. Mostly, he said. Toward the end of the ceremony, at midnight, a figurine of the baby Jesus was placed into a crib in a small nativity on the hearth. We then kneeled and stood once more and took communion with something like a saltine. Our final task was grabbing each other's hands, intently staring into each other's eyes and saying, "Peace we be with you," over and over. "Peace be with you." These people running really wanted me, demanded that I be at peace. It was 1 a.m. on Christmas Day when we left Marie's house. I marveled at that day's beauty, the beautiful mountains, the beautiful, if exhausting, ceremony, the beautiful kindness, the beautiful family. I could not recall ever experiencing any day quite so sincerely beautiful. When I woke up Christmas Day, all the siblings were there. A buzz of cooking and chatter, a perfume of good food permeated the house. I homed in on the kitchen. Breakfast appeared in front of me as if magic. I was joking with a middle brother, Oscar, about the importance of moose nuggets in Alaskan culture when Andre's mom walked by. Oscar let me know that his mom, Mrs. Valdez, worked as a chef. So good a chef, her tamales were in demand around the globe, as far away as Germany. This fact bode well for the meal, which would not be served until mid-afternoon. This family did not open gifts on Christmas morning. That was different. In my family, there was an orgy of gift opening and wrapping paper and piles of desired gifts separated from the clothes, separated from the what were they thinking pile. But here, no. Instead, from breakfast to the Christmas meal, I twirled around people carrying plates of food. I answered lots of questions about living in Alaska. I grabbed silverware and set it out to placement rules I learned long ago and mostly forgotten. Wine was uncorked, glassware set out. Then all 20 siblings, the spouses and Mrs. Valdez, sat at the long table set up in the living room. Faces were damp from moisture, boiled off pozoles and braised pork shoulders. Large bowls of salad, squash, and charred asparagus sat on the table. There was ham and turkey, but also burritos and enchilada. There were world-famous tamales. Mrs. Valdez nodded to Conrad. "The prayer, please." Conrad solemnly bowed his head, as did the others, and, heaving a great sigh, spoke. "Rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub. Yay, God!" And we dove in. Somewhere in the happy sounds of chewing, I asked Andres about the prayer. "Wasn't that a tad, you know, disrespectful? You mean the yay, God thing? I think God can handle it." I could handle the tamales. These were my first ever tamales, a void of cultural ignorance soon filled by the consumption of an obscene amount of tamales. I loved how you had to unwrap the tamales from the corn husk, letting the steam hit your face. It smelled of sweet corn. The pork filling was fatty and moist, and was that cinnamon I was tasting? "My God, I love these tamales," I said. Andres piped in, "You wouldn't be the first to find God in Mom's tamales." "I'm glad you are enjoying them," said Mrs. Valdez. Afterwards, I tried to wash a few dishes in the kitchen. Mrs. Valdez must have seen me as she shushed me out. "Now is not the time for dishes. Now is the time for dancing." She must have seen the terror in my eyes. "Oh, mi hijo, not you." She gently cupped my cheek. "Don't you know? The farther north from the equator you were born, the less able you are to move your hips." "No, dance is done by my daughters. Come." Christmas Day was not over, not yet. The sisters had changed. They were wearing sky blue dresses with large layered skirts and matching flowers in their black hair, which was down for the first time that day. They were beautiful. They danced like something between a light march and flamenco to Conrad's lone guitar. It was a simple melody. The sisters picked up the edges of their layered dresses and spun the material, creating a wave effect. The waves broke with the chord changes, and then singing began in Spanish. I was moved by the intimacy of the dance, the close relationship of the siblings, the anticipation of each other's movements and music, like a flock of starlings, a school of fish, or tall grass in a breeze. They moved like sentient liquid in mystifying concert, and from it came a comfort and calm. I went to an idyllic place, like watching an amazing concert or play, a place where everyone around you agrees, this is special, this is amazing. Part of me was envious, even a little sad. I had never seen anything like this before. Most of us on Christmas open presents, watch football, eat a big meal, fall asleep. Here I was, watching the most beautiful thing in my 20 years, days filled with family, tradition, delicious food, and dance. I wide-eyed watched those sisters move when someone nudged my shoulder. Mrs. Valdez was standing next to me and smiling. I gave her a small smile back. I scanned the room while the music and dance filled the space. The brothers swayed. All of them were smiling. The spouses were smiling. The kids were smiling. I walked over to Andres and whispered, "Do you think I could come back here with you, you know, for Easter?" Eyebrows rising ever so slightly, Andres nodded and said, "There will be religion involved."
Our next piece is by Jeff Kirsch. Jeff is a professional writer whose credits include Comedy Central, The Huffington Post, and the WGN America Network. His work has appeared in a number of publications, including Adventure Cyclist, Cornell Magazine, The Jewish Daily Forward, Subaru's Drive Magazine, Hardcore Muscle, several pieces in that one, actually, and the Juno Empire, where he writes a biweekly column called Slack Tide. Jeff will read his piece, Alaskonica.
You didn't move all the way from New York to Alaska to reconnect with Judaism, and yet that's exactly where you find yourself, more Lower East Side than Great Northwest, seeking guidance from your rabbi on a spiritual matter. Your daughter wants a Christmas tree. Although she's been asking about it for several holiday seasons, she's getting old enough now to construct more compelling arguments. She's also enlisted her brother. And your wife. Clever girl. Let the record show she also wants a ring-tailed lemur, and you aren't consulting your local zookeeper about that. Good thing, too, that would require a schlep up to Anchorage. The fact that your town, a toehold at the foot of the world's fifth largest ice field, with no roads in or out, even has a rabbi, is excuse enough to seek his counsel. You've heard of fellow tribesmen, and you don't mean Tlingit, Haida, or Tsimshian, traveling from as far as Whitehorse, Yukon territories for an audience with this rabbi, a recent Lower 48 evacuee who wound up here like you because of his wife's job. Not only is he the region's first permanent rabbi, he's the only rabbi for thousands of miles. And so you meet over bagels and lox, no shortage of smoked fish in Alaska, that's for sure, if only to provide an authority figure to blame for an unpopular decision. Indeed, the rabbi knows this. He once described himself as a walking guilt machine for Juno's Jewish community. You yourself practice a fusion Judaism, or feudism. You conceive of ideas like frying potato latkes in bacon fat. You do not tell the rabbi this out of respect for his kosher ears. And dream of impregnating traditional Passover matzah balls with deli corned beef and pastrami. You call it the meatza ball. This you do share with the rabbi, and he seems enthusiastic. But when you're honest with yourself, though, you're mostly Jewish by convenience. For instance, talking with your grandmother, or watching Woody Allen movies, or describing Anchorage as a schlep, or asking your rabbi to back you up. "Back me up here, Rabbi," you plead between bites of your nosh. That's the only other Yiddish word you know. Well, That and certain anatomical parts, alongside several acts you might perform with those parts. But you just don't think a Christmas tree belongs in your home. It's like those people who hang up Tibetan prayer flags, even though they're blatantly not Tibetan. The rabbi nods thoughtfully. You continue. Living in the middle of a boreal forest, we're literally surrounded by Christmas trees. At least according to your three-year-old son, who points them out one after the other from the back seat. Christmas tree, Dad! Another Christmas tree, Dad! More Christmas trees, Dad! Disavowing him of this notion, no, son, that's actually a western hemlock, that is a yellow cedar, and those are Sitka spruce, would ruin the rest of the drive and possibly the entire afternoon for everyone. Although, Alaska itself serves as a constant Yuletide reminder. For one, it begins to look a lot like Christmas in mid-October. And walking in a winter wonderland remains a popular pastime well through May. Not to mention all the false Santa Clauses who live up here. Recent census puts Alaska's population at 731,450, and you swear half of those people are old guys with pot bellies and long white beards. Plus, where else on earth do you find real live reindeer? Okay, fine, Norway, Finland, Siberia, Greenland, and Canada. But where else do they eat Rudolph for breakfast? Or grind Donner into chili before nailing Blitzer's antlers to their mailbox? And there's only one North Pole. Well, actually, that's not entirely true either. You've got geographic North Pole, magnetic North Pole, the hamlet of North Pole in the Adirondack Mountains near Lake Placid. But there is only one incorporated city of North Pole, and it's in Alaska, 99705. And that place is filthy with false Santas. Aren't you getting a little off topic, the rabbi asks. Sorry, rabbi, you say. See, walking guilt machine. Anyway, you tell him, you recognize Christmas trees are more secular symbols than religious. And you like Christmas. Most Jews do. It's hard not to love a holiday that spells two straight months of eggnog. You expound. You're not a Grinch or a Scrooge or a Charlie Brown from that old holiday special. You've got no problem saying Merry Christmas, nor do you get your yarmulke in a bunch when someone says it to you. Who has the time or energy to take issue with the wishing of merriment? I mean, any kind of merriment. But while the war on Christmas is not your war, it's simply not your holiday either. And that, you tell the rabbi, is why you don't want a Christmas tree, no matter how tempting the excuse to run your chainsaw. Again, the rabbi nods. They must drill this gesture in seminary. I think that's what you should tell your daughter, he says at last. Although, maybe not the part about the chainsaw. It's easy for him to say. He's not the one dealing with the fallout, by which you mean the meltdowns. Whoever wrote, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned," obviously never spent winter recess with a disappointed kindergartner. Please, you will take a scorned woman any day. The rabbi ponders this a moment. Well, he says, instead of focusing on the holidays you don't celebrate, make something special of the ones you do. Well, suddenly, this rabbinical tete-a-tete doesn't seem that ridiculous, and you're almost sorry you made fun of it earlier. Almost. Because he's provided the solution. This year and henceforth, you will create for your children a Hanukkah to top all Hanukkahs. Yes, the great Alaskan Hanukkah. You'll call it Alaskanukkah. The festival of northern lights. Break out that old menorah and put on your dreidel spinning shoes, because for 8 nights you're gonna party like it's 165 BCE. And then you're just gonna keep on celebrating Alaska Hanukkah right on through New Year's, mostly because you're too lazy to take down the decorations. In fact, your glow-in-the-dark skeleton still suction cup to the front window from Halloween, 2009. Little background. Hanukkah, also known as the Festival of Lights, that is its real name, celebrates a small band of ancient Hebrews who, after defeating the Syrian Greek army and liberating Jerusalem, rededicated the Holy Temple, of which the Western Wall still stands, by lighting one day's worth of oil that miraculously lasted 8. Hence, lighting a ceremonial 8-candled Hanukkah menorah. The point is, aside from providing the first ever documented warning about over-reliance on non-renewable energy, Hanukkah holds little actual religious significance. This is perfect because the prime purpose of Alaska Hanukkah will be supporting our consumer-based economy. After all, even in Alaska, you're still part of America, land of the free, home of the Whopper. In keeping with your seasonal tradition of consuming salt, fat, and sugar, you will cook and eat latkes, which are essentially deep-fried hash browns. What's more, you will bring them into your children's classrooms and conduct little show-and-tell presentations, just as your own mother once did for you. This, all joking aside, remains a cherished childhood memory, and isn't supplying cherished childhood memories your job now? Added bonus, the other traditional Hanukkah food, donuts. Not only will you highlight this ritual and all in this and all future Alaska Hanukkah celebrations, it turns out you've been observing it all along. Every time you drive past the convenience store out by the airport, sorry, Rabbi, you tell him, expressing your gratitude by admitting yet another perceived transgression, but you just can't resist their maple bacon bars. So good, they're sacrilegious. Thank you. Glad I could. There's always one of those in everything that I write. Glad I could help, the rabbi answers with a straight face. And now, if you'll excuse me, I'm off to perform a circumcision. I'm running a special this month, half off. You were not expecting that exit line. You've got to remember to write it down. But for now, time to get home and string more lights around the deck railing. For Alaska Hanukkah, yes, but also to see the grill better. The other night, you totally scorched some Alaska Hanukkah reindeer sausage, which was kind of like getting a lump of coal in your stocking, only you had to eat it. And you'd almost run out of ketchup. Thankfully, though, the dregs of that bottle lasted way longer than expected. Maybe not 8 nights, but long enough to avert a kitty mutiny, at least for one meal. Now that was a true Alaska Hanukkah miracle.
Rockwell Kent, who lived from 1882 to 1971, is one of America's most celebrated graphic artists. His works have appeared in Shakespeare's Complete Works and Moby Dick, to name a few. In 1918, Kent and his son spent Christmas south of Seward on Fox Island at the entrance of Resurrection Bay. Later, Kent wrote A Northern Christmas based on the experience. The piece will be read tonight by Ryan Conero. Ryan is a Juno actor and director.
The south coast of the mainland of Alaska is a wilderness of spruce-clad mountains whose outlying isolated peaks are islands. On one of these, we lived, a father and his 8-year-old son, the man in pursuit of his profession, the boy in pursuit of what of education lay in doing things, and both in that pursuit of happiness, which, with whatever right, is still what every living creature wants. They had come a long, long way, these two, and what they sought, they found. If home is where what you desire is, then we'd come home. There in the forest we lived, our house, a one-room cabin crudely built of logs and caulked with moss. Our view, a crescent cove, the bay, the mountains of the distant shore, the sky, the moon and stars at night. And for companionship, ourselves, each other, and a genial, wise, and kind old man, an old sourdough of early gold rush days, old trapper, lifelong pioneer, a Swede named Olsen. We three, a pair of foxes shut in a corral, a milk goat christened Nanny, an obstreperous Angora goat, one Billy, otters that now and then sat basking on the rocks, blue jays and gulls, and porcupines. It was enough. Of the fullness of the days, we kept record. From that book, these notes about a happy Christmas in the North are drawn. Thursday, December 19th. This day is never to be forgotten, so beautiful, so calm, so still, with the earth and every branch and tree muffled in deep, feathery, new-fallen snow. And all day the softest clouds have drifted lazily over the heaven, shrouding the land here and there in veils of falling snow, while elsewhere, or through the snow itself, the sun shone. Golden shadows, dazzling peaks, fairy tracery of branches against the blue summer sea. It was a day to live, and work could be forgotten. So young Rockwell and I explored the woods, at first reverently treading one path so that the snow about us might still lie undisturbed. But soon, the cub and the boy broke out, and he rolled into the deepest thickets, shook the trees down upon himself, lay still in the snow for me to cover him completely, washed his face till it was crimson, and wound up with a naked snow bath. I photographed him standing thus in the deep snow at the water's edge with the mountains far off behind him. Then he dried himself at the roaring fire we'd made ready, and he felt like a new boy, if that can be imagined. Meanwhile, I searched in the woods for a Christmas tree and cut a fair-sized one at last for its top. Christmas is right upon us now. Tonight, the cranberries stew on the stove. Friday, December 20th. The beautiful snow is fast going under the falling rain. With only 5 more days before Christmas, it's probable we'll have little, if any, snow on the ground then. A snowless Christmas in Alaska. This day was as uneventful as could be. Hardly an hour of daylight. These days slip by so easily and with so little accomplished. Only by burning midnight oil can much be done. Monday, December 23rd. Up to this morning, the hard, warm rain continued, and now the stars are all out, and it might be thought a night in spring. If old man Olson believes, as he says, that Christmas will pass as any other day, he is quite wrong. The tree waits to be set up, and it will surely be a thing of beauty, blazing with its many candles in this somber log interior. I've given up the idea of dressing Olson as Santa Claus in goat's wool whiskers. Santa Claus without presents would move us to tears. There are a few little gifts. A pocket knife and a kitchen set of knife, fork, and a can opener for Olson. An old broken fountain pen for Rockwell. Some sticks of candy. And today I finished a little picture for Olson, and so did Rockwell. These were forgotten in my list of presents as I've just written it. I wish we had more to give the good old man. At any rate, he dines with us. Christmas Eve. We've cleaned the house, stowed everything away upon shelves and hooks and in corners, moved even my easel aside, decorated the roof timbers with dense hemlock boughs, stowed quantities of wood behind the stove, for there must be no work on that holiday. And now both young Rockwell and I are in a state of suppressed excitement over tomorrow. What a strange thing. Nothing is coming to us. No change in any respect in the routine of our lives but what we make ourselves. And yet, the day looms so large and magnificent before us. I suppose the greatest festivals of our lives are those at which we dance ourselves. You need nothing from the outside, not even illusion. Certainly children need to be given scarcely an idea to develop out of it an atmosphere of mystery and expectation as real and thrilling to themselves as if it rested upon true belief. Well, the tree is ready, cut to length with a cross at the foot to stand upon, and a cardboard and tinfoil star to hang at its top. And now, as to Christmas weather. This morning, as might just as well have been expected, was again overcast. Toward evening, light snow began to fall. It soon turned to rain, and the rain now has settled down to a gentle, even, all night and day pace. Let it snow or rain and grow dark at midday. The better shall be our good Christmas cheer within. This is the true Christmas land. The day should be dark, the house further overshadowed by the woods, tall and black. And there, in the midst of that somber, dreadful gloom, the Christmas tree should blaze in glory, unrivaled by moon or sun or star. Christmas Day on Fox Island. It's mild. The ground is almost bare and a warm rain falls. First, the Christmas tree, all dripping wet, is brought into the house and set upon its feet. It's 9 feet and a half high and just touches the peak of the cabin. There it stands and dries its leaves while Rockwell and I prepare the feast. Both stoves are kept burning and the open door lets in the cool air. Everything goes beautifully. The wood burns as it should, the oven heats, the kettle boils, the beans stew, the bread browns in the oven just right. And the new pudding sauce foams up as rich and delicious as though instead of the first, it were the 100th time I'd made it. And now everything is ready. The clock stands at 2:45. Night has about fallen, and the lamplight is in the cabin. Run, Rockwell, out of doors and play a while. Quickly, I stow the presents about the tree, hang sticks of candy from it, and light the candles. Rockwell runs for Mr. Olson, and just as they approach the cabin, the door opens and fairyland is revealed to them. It's wonderful. The interior of the cabin is illuminated as never before, as perhaps no cabin interior ever was among these wild mountains. Then, all amazed and wondering, those two children come in. who knows which is the more entranced? Then old man Olson and I drink in deep solemnity a silent toast. And the old man says, I'd give everything. Yes, everything I have in the world to have your wife here now. And the presents are handed out. For Olson, this picture from Rockwell. Ah, he thinks it's wonderful. Then for Rockwell, this book, a surprise from Seward. Next for Olson, a painting, a kitchen set, a pocket knife. By this time, he's quite overcome. It's the first Christmas he's ever had. And Rockwell, when he's handed two old copies of the Geographic magazine, cries in amazement, why, I thought I was to have no presents. But in addition, he gets a pocket knife and the broken fountain pen, and he sits on the bed looking at the things as though they were the most wonderful of gifts. Dinner is now set upon the table. Olson adjusts his glasses and reads the formal menu that lies at his place. Menu, Fox Island, Christmas, 1918. Olives, pickles, spaghetti a la Fox Island, beans a la Resurrection Bay, Murphy's and casserole, cranberry sauce, plum pudding magnifique, sauce a la Alaska rum, home sweet home cider. So we feast, and we have a jolly good time. It's a true party, and it looks like one. Rockwell and I are in clean white shirts. Olson is magnificent in a new flannel shirt and his Sunday trousers and waistcoat. He wears a silk tie with a gold nugget pin. He's shaven, and he's clipped about the ears. How grand he looks. The food is good and plentiful. The night is long. Only the Christmas candles are short-lived, and we extinguish them to save them for another time. Finally, as the night deepens, Olson leaves us amid mutual expressions of delight in one another's friendship, and Rockwell and I tumble into bed. So ended Christmas on Fox Island. As life had been, so after Christmas it went on. With spring, too soon, the time for our enforced departure came. We left Fox Island. Tearfully, on the threshold of the world, I wrote, and now at last it is over. Fox Island will soon become in our memories like a dream or vision, a remote experience too wonderful for the full liberty we knew there and the deep peace to be remembered or believed in as a real experience in life. It was, for us, life as it should be, serene and wholesome, love but no hate, faith without disillusionment, the absolute for the toiling hands of man and for his soaring spirit. Olson, of the deep experience, strong, brave, generous, and gentle like a child, and his island, like paradise. God. And now the world again.
Well, thank you, writers, and thank you, actors, and thank you, audience, for your participation in Arts at 360's Writers Showcase.